Hello and welcome to Toy Power. This is your podcast where we talk toys and all things pop culture. I'm Trent, and today we're joined on the couch by Darren and Ben. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you very much, Trent, for the invite, as per usual.
A pleasure to be here, guys.
So for this episode, we want to round out our analysis of He-Man the Master Universe from New York Toy Fair 2017. And from there, what we want to do is touch on a new book that's been released by Dark Horse, which is a compilation of the He-Man and the Masters of the Universe newspaper strips from the late 80s, early 90s. We want to also have a bit of a chat, and I'm going to throw this one to you guys without a lot of notice, on Mythic Legions. And I've got a question that I do want to pose to you, Darren and Ben. And we want to maybe see where that conversation goes in terms of what's happening in the toy industry and where we think it's heading, what lines we might think we might be able to get to as we head on into the future. So on that, we'll head right into New York and Masters of the Universe.
Love the fact that Super 7 are branching out and doing other things with Masters of the Universe, and really, really hoping that there's the, I guess, the customer base to support that. It's cool to see it sort of, you know, being branching out. I've become a huge fan of the Kenneth Style reaction stuff. It's, the line's grown on me as it's gone on. I guess the art on the cards is pretty hard to pass up. That's sensational, and that really brings each release alive for me.
Yeah, definitely. I fell in love with the Cobra Khan artwork on the reaction figure card back. I think that alone is absolutely sensational. And I've only got He-Man and Skeletor from that reaction line, but I think I'll have to get a Cobra Khan for the artwork alone. I think he looks fantastic. As for the Motussle or Muscle figures, fantastic to see the line become so diverse. They've got Snake Mountain now, they've got Panther, they've got Battle Armor, He-Man and Skeletor, all these characters and things that I didn't think, you know, would be viable, and yet here they are. That's worth maybe thinking about. And I've got the big 24-pack set of the original line, and if the 24-pack set, complete set, is available for this Wave 2, that's a strong possibility. I might pick that thing up and, display it, because I just think, that's really, really cool.
Yeah, no, look, I loved seeing those, the continuation of that line. Yeah, Cobra Khan was a standout, but I guess going back and doing Battle Armor versions of He-Man and Skeletor,
very
good way
cool
to keep it front of mind and keep them the big two out there, I guess.
And they've got axes this time instead of swords, which was just to change it up. So very cool.
Yeah, no, that's very cool. And obviously a big fan of the artwork that's showing up on those cards. That really makes, I mean, like you said, you could buy it essentially for that artwork.
Oh, of course you could. I mean, it's vintage style Master Universe art on something that really is only just a tribute line. They've gone all out on that.
Yeah. No, that's cool. All right. Well, we might move on. I think the next thing we've got, and it's taking a bit of a step back and a step away from the toys, but we wanted to touch on Dark Horse and a book that they've put out in the last month, which is the newspaper strips. So it's a compilation of all the newspaper strips that appeared, and it was basically a daily run of strips that ran over about 4 years. So incredibly good run, done as a continuation of the Filmation series. So it sort of picks up, I guess, where Filmation left off, and gives characters that didn't get a chance to be portrayed in Filmation, gives them a bit of a spotlight and a chance to shine. And so we're getting some, not only some new stories in that Filmation style, but also we're introduced to new characters. It sort of starts off, I guess, with a story which brings, you know, He-Man and Skeletor together. We see the rock people in that. We get Granitor showing up in that. And then it moves on to, I guess, the introduction of King Hiss. So what it would have been like to get King Hiss in Filmation. And then the story that I'm up to now is brilliant, because it's the introduction of Ninjor. And it features Scareglow Just like, I guess, the original vintage mini comic brings in, you know, the search for Keldor, where we've got Ninjor teaming up with Scareglow. They're essentially brought in by Skeletor from another dimension to help in his evil plot to prevent Randor and the heroic warriors from locating or finding out what happened to Keldor. So yeah, just the fact that these are vintage stories from the era that I'd suspect 99% of fans haven't been exposed to. So to get that in a complete collection is just phenomenal. So gentlemen, you guys have picked up these books and
oh,
had
yes.
a chance to have a look. I think I've got three of them. I liked it that much. So I picked up three copies. But what are your thoughts on the book?
Absolutely love it. Fantastic. I mean, as Trent said, it's something that's very, very vintage, but also something that's very, very new, because I haven't seen it. All the stuff I have been exposed to, I'd never seen it. So I don't even know if it ran in Australia. Love to find out, though. But, yeah, look, I absolutely adore it. Obviously, it's Dark Horse, and if people are familiar with the mini comic book and the art book and the Filmation He-Man and She-Ra book, they've got a pretty rough idea of what they're getting when they pick up this. You know, it keeps that tradition alive of, you know, being a high-quality Masters of the Universe product published by Dark Horse, but at a pretty modest price. And, yeah, the stories themselves are just sensational.
Yeah, so I've picked up the book as well. I've only had a chance to read the first chapter, which features the Rock people and Granita and Hordak and Shredder, Skeletor and things. I was extremely impressed with it. I wasn't sure what sort of level of maturity it would be, whether it would be that the sort of fun and gags and sarcasm like the Filmation cartoon, or I didn't know what sort of it would be like. And I was extremely impressed of the fluid storytelling, the maturity of the overall book, like 30 something years on, and it's a mature comic. A mature adult could read it without any problems at all and not think it's, you know, it's meant for kids or anything. So massive thumbs up for that reason. Yeah, and
mature, second to last page, He-Man's making out with some chick.
So yeah, definitely. I cannot wait to explore some of the further options and in the book, like such as Ninjor and Scareglow and some of the other characters that we're didn't get their time, their limelight in the cartoons or much more than what they got in the mini comics. So extremely excited to continue to read this. I think it's couldn't have been put together better. A massive, in such an enormous dedication to find all the panels and things for the 4 years. It's my, you know, hats off to everyone. Daniel Galerta, who I think you know, did almost most of it. Massive respects. Cannot, you know, thank you enough for providing it to people like us who have not been exposed to it before. So,
yeah, to Danielle and the team that went through microfilm and I think it's traveling to different countries to basically pull this thing together. Sensational job, and even to the extent that they couldn't locate every strip down, the fact that they managed to source the original script so they could fill in the blanks and you get a continuity of story was just a genius move. So that's phenomenal. So yeah, to the team that pulled this together, that's sensational. And to Dark Horse for, I guess, having faith in the property that they can put out a book like this and just know it's gonna meet that fan demand is a really good credit to where Dark Horse is going.
Absolutely, well said, gentlemen. I mean, people often forget about the kind of work that goes into doing something like this, and we are talking about newspaper strips that appeared in the late 80s and early 90s. So we are talking about a lot of research, microfilm, old newspapers. But the results just paid off. It's a beautiful looking book. And obviously the story's there as well, and it's a great read. But, I mean, every amount of effort has gone to make sure the story's done justice in the presentation by Dark Horse. And I have to agree with Trent, you know, it is great to see Dark Horse sort of back the property in like this. You know, we've had quite a few publications from Dark Horse lately, and which is really exciting, and we've got another one just around the corner in, I reckon, about a month.
Yeah, the encyclopedia is coming out, and oh, we talked about this in a previous podcast, just the level that the He-Man community goes to on these books is just, I don't think it's, it happens in any other property. I think we talked about that as a subject of one of our podcasts. It's, and I think the encyclopedia is going to pretend, I mean, James Etok and some of the work he did, the art book, you know, it's gone to a next level. But if you think about hearing some of the stories that, that Val and has referenced in, I guess, the way they coordinated this encyclopedia, and I, it's just going to be amazing to see the level of detail they go to and how deep this thing goes, the amount of pages. Just the one thing about the art book as well. I mean, it's 500-odd pages. Obviously, the, only the Sundays were printed in colour, so, you know, 50% of the book is in black and white, but that's, you know... That's...
So you get, yeah, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday is black and white, which is usually 99% of the book is three panels, and then you get a larger panel for the Sunday strip, which is, to us, is very close to what the Phantom comics are printed here in Australia.
Yep.
So it's, yeah, you can sort of... associate it with that sort of scenario. So for them to go through, yeah, as we've said, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and so on of every paper to find that one panel, that three panels of comics, that's a lot of time.
Yeah. Oh, a huge effort. And yeah, I mean, it's a labor of love, really. That's, you know, not done for the money. I'm sure it's done for the love of the property and getting this stuff out there. And, you know, and Danielle's really driven this one. But yeah, like 500 odd pages, this thing is enormous. I mean, it's probably the biggest, I guess, in height book that we've got. I think it's the pages are a bit thinner than say the art book, but, it's a monster of a book, and I can't believe how they're getting these retail prices, $29.99 US for this book. And we were picking it up off Amazon, and I got it from one of my copies from the local comic book store at $45 Australian. I mean, it's just, it's insane for this thing. I mean, you can buy two or three of these and just keep some, you know, mint on your shelf.
Absolutely, you can. And I've been doing that with previous Dark Horse books, and I'll be doing that again with this one. Because you do want, well, you know, the collector in me wants some that look like their museum quality, but on the same token, you don't want to pass up the opportunity to actually read the thing.
Yeah. No, that's sensational. Yeah, can't wait for the encyclopedia. So I'm sure we'll get to that in one of our future podcasts. So you can't recommend it enough. If you haven't picked it up and you're a Masters fan, you can pick it up. Any online bookstore should have it, or the big ones. And it looks to me like some of the local comic book stores are carrying it as well. Not sure if it's shown up in the major bookstores here in Australia yet.
Dimmicks had it on their website for pre-order some time ago, because I was just having a look to see what was happening. I know you can order the art book off of Dimmicks' website as well, and the mini comic book on it. Yeah, can't remember if the Filmation book's on there. But, gentlemen, I wanted to get your thoughts while we're talking Dark Horse about... No, obviously we're getting the encyclopedia shortly, and I don't want to talk about it too much because I haven't seen it yet. But I'm just sort of thinking, if five books in Dark Horse decide they want to keep going with this, and let's hope they do, where's your thinking on what you'd like to see next? I know there was a poll done a couple of years ago on He-Man.org, and I think most of us, if not all of us, probably voted on that. We all probably have opinions. I'd love to hear your thoughts on, you know, what Dark Horse could do for book number six. Maybe even book number seven.
Yeah, my vote, actually, I remember that poll, and I think it was before the newspaper strip came out, because I remember voting for this. This would have been my top vote. I guess there's probably, in my mind, a gap for me personally, is I don't have a lot of the comics. So there were some comics done by Marvel, or their...
So the American ones?
I'm thinking Star. Star Comics, American. Yep. But look, I guess once you open that vault, there's so much that that is out there in terms of the comics or the Ladybird books.
There's
annuals, you know, they had an annual running up from the start to the end of the line.
I'd even be curious to know whether or not they can even touch the Star comics or whether or not they remain in the realm of Marvel.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. I don't know the answer to that, but I'm sure there is a hurdle to be crossed there. If Dark Horse are going to do it, because essentially they're competing companies.
Yeah. So for me personally, and I remember that poll as well, I personally didn't vote on the comic strips because I didn't know what I was voting for in the comic strips. I didn't had no references or whatever for the comic strips, and I didn't know about them. So I'm so happy we've got the newspaper comic strips now because they're absolutely sensational. But for me, when I voted, it was the UK comics.
Yep.
The UK comics, for those that don't know, went into so much more depth than the American Star comics ones. I'm not sure what the UK ones. I think they might have been Star as well, were they? Or
I don't think Marvel? So. I think that was someone
another
else.
One, yeah. Yeah. So and they went into the hundreds or something.
Yeah, they went issues over. Yeah,
because,
over 100.
There's
a couple of different series.
Yeah, classically in the UK they were produced weekly, if not fortnightly. So you run up, and they weren't a very thick comic. They were only a few pages long. But obviously you've got unique cover art for each, and you ran into the hundreds of comics within a few years because of that the frequency that they were coming out. I do have the American Star comics, the 1 to 12 or 13 or
13
whatever.
Plus the movie adaptation.
Yeah, so I've got all them. I've got the
same here.
I've got an original DC Presents where He-Man fights Superman. They were fairly easily attainable for me that many years ago when I'm at my height of my comic book collecting. But the UK ones, I've maybe got less than a dozen of. And it's mostly because not only the rarity of them, but for me to ship one of those comics from the UK or wherever, whoever's got them, to Australia, it just... the shipping just destroys any,
really need to be buying a bundle
to
get any value out of the shipping side of it to Australia. I'm like Ben, I've probably got maybe a dozen or so at the most, maybe 15, give or take, but not many. And I would love to see that untapped. I honestly can't remember what I voted for, which is interesting. Because I know that I wrestled with it for a while. I didn't vote straight away, and it was between the newspaper comic strips and those UK comics. And the reason for that being, I did have a bit of an idea. I had seen some panels posted by people before from the newspaper strips. I did have a bit of an idea of what it was and what it might be like. But I also had a taste of those UK comics, and it was a really difficult decision because they were the two vintage things that I thought I don't really have, and I'd love to see that happen. But I'd be very, very keen on the UK stuff. But everything on that list was home run, as far as I was concerned. And I don't know if you remember all the things that were on it, but there was a toy, history of the different toy lines and, you know, all sorts of different things that I think we'd all be, you know, pretty proud to have in our collections. I don't think there's any wrong game, but I guess I'm the kind of person I always look to, if the next book is the last book, what one would you want it to be?
Or
if you could only have one more or only have two more, and I find those questions and conversations really interesting because that really gets to the crux of what people are desperate to get.
Yeah, I mean, the other big thing for me is, you know, we got, obviously, book one was an art book. And prior to the art book, we had The Power and the Honor put out, I guess, a version of art and prototype pictures focused on the toy. And then prior to that, we had the very limited release art book, you know, volume one made by Mattel, which was put out at San Diego Comic-Con, I think limited to 1,000 pieces. And the rarity and scarcity of that book. In my opinion, those three books have really only scratched the surface of what is there from an art perspective.
Of course.
You could just do, art of the toys.
You could even do a different art book every year, or every 6 months.
Produced art of the toys, not even going down the prototype line to say, here's all the art that came with the original toys, you know, and that would be a book in its own right. And you know, part of the reason why I collect Mint on Card is to get that art. You know, if you're getting a Mint in Box spy door that you want to keep sealed, it's factory sealed, you know, you're basically buying that for that beautiful artwork. And to get that in a publication that I guess is complete, because the art books to date obviously have touched a number of different aspects of art, it can only give you a flavour of that sort of stuff. So I'd love to see that, Rick, because that's such a big part of what is Masters.
That's
is
a very
is the
good quote.
Art we
yeah.
got on the toys, the produced art that we got. Forget about the prototype stuff, which is really cool, but just to get that, you know, compile. You could even go down, you know, the posters and...
Well, you could have the backs of the card backs with yeah. the, you know, the art that we got from Super 7.
Yeah.
The panels and things. And even down the side, you could have a picture of the, you know, what the character Mint on Card looks like, and then flip it on the back and show it, you know, the back of the card. And that could be, you know, double page for each character, and then go into the vehicles and things. And I added you guys to that link that I found on Facebook, and it showed all the art of the toys. And it's fascinating to see the art for the... Flying Fist He-Man versus Terraclaw's Skeletor. You know, those two packs and things, the art that those two packs are so rare and scarce, and the artwork on them is amazing. And to capture that in a, you know, beautiful format in a printed book for everyone to look at, it'd be fantastic.
Yeah, that art is stunning. And I've often looked at it a lot over the years. I was in many ways sorry that it never came out here, but it was one of the reasons why I was so keen to hear that Maddie were doing the Flying Fist He-Man versus Terraclaw Skeletor 2-pack, because it really did hit on the nostalgia waves. And I understand why they didn't do the art, because they wanted it to be consistent packaging, but how cool would it have been if they had? Yeah. And that. But even so, it did still tip the hat to the fact that they'd been in the vintage line offered as a 2-pack.
Yes. Yep.
No, that's very good. Look, we'll move on then away from him. We're going to go back to He-Man for one more. Sorry,
one
I missed
more thing.
It. Yep.
One more thing on the He-Man franchise that came out of New York was Loyal Subjects. Loyal Subjects continue to churn out their license on the Master of the Universe. So we've seen the Wave 1, which is sort of Filmation-based color schemes. Then the Wave 2, which was the Walmart exclusives. There were more toy representations, coloured schemes for the little Loyal Subjects, and then I don't know the official waves or whatever, but what I dub Wave 3, we're getting very wacky repaints. So just to name a few, you see Disco Skeletor, you see Blood Skeletor, all from the 2000X line, Green Slime Pit He-Man. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. They're churning out repaints of Triclops and everyone. So that was represented at New York, and take it or leave it if that's your cup of tea. But it's cool to see them continuing the Master of the Universe license, even if it's just more variants. So.
And huge props to the Loyal Subjects, and I mean that sincerely. For getting Masters of the Universe back, as I was saying, huge props to Loyal Subjects to getting Masters of the Universe back into stores like Walmart. I mean, that's no small undertaking.
Yeah, I've been listening to a number of the podcasts. So, you know, Roast Google Dinner, I think, you know, Rob Bass, and listening to the searching and the excitement. I think Nate Barch did an opening, you know, he was sort of, I think he was hanging out for Skeletor and he got it, you know, he did a live opening on one of the podcasts. But yeah, it's just, you know, it's not something for me, and that's fine. I still love the fact it's out there, and it's got that mainstream release. It's got people excited. They're on the hunt. They're going in. It's blind box. It's created this buzz, which is so cool. Daniel Benedict, you know, there's so much excitement when you listen to them talking about it. And they told me something that I didn't know, And I felt like I was, you know, going into the world of Roald Dahl you know, this concept of the golden He-Man. You know, one golden He-Man. I don't know if it's, you know, five like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, five golden tickets, but you know, some very limited number of and it's a cool version to do a really limited release on, because if you don't get a golden VAC metal He-Man,
it's
you're
not going to break your collection.
It's not going to break your collection. But imagine, you know, finding the really super obscure golden He-Man. I think there's something really cool about that, that buzz and that excitement that it's creating. So well done to Loyal Subjects.
It's also nice, especially from what I've seen in my Australian Facebook community. It's opened up the avenue for people who's been a bit late on the line, haven't collected the classics, or have got one or two classics and completely missed the boat on most of them, and now they're too expensive. All of a sudden, it's given them an avenue to be there from the start and collect a line from the get-go, to collect all the variants and all the characters, and then get excited when Wave 2 gets released, and, oh, cool, I can go out and get them. So it's been, you know, congratulations to those people that's their area, that they've been there right at the beginning to start their new He-Man collection. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. We might move on then, and I'm going to hijack the segment for a little bit just to talk about something I was really excited about. And, you know, to Darren and Ben, if it wasn't your thing or you didn't get into it, then that's cool. But there is something I want to draw out of that, because it was something that listening to Eric Treadaway talk about really resonated with me and made me think about collecting more generally and the sorts of stuff we collect. So I did want to tease that out of you. So I'll go there in a minute. But the topic I wanted to talk about was Mythic Legions and the Kickstarter that's just been and gone and was a huge success. So Mythic Legions is a line that has been designed and created from scratch by the Four Horsemen. And clearly we're talking about the Four Horsemen and the link to He-Man, because the Four Horsemen have been synonymous with, I guess, the modern iteration of He-Man in toy form. So they were really instrumental, I guess, in sculpting for the 2002 line that tied into the Mike Young Productions cartoon. And they've been involved ever since. And when you actually take a step back, and I was listening to the podcast of Roast Google Dinner, where they had Eric from the Four Horsemen on there, and they're actually sort of saying, you know, you guys have been doing this, obviously, sculpting since 2002, and to get those sculpts ready for that line, you might have been involved, you know, a couple of years before. So to sort of think about it, they've been on this line, you know, for 15 plus years. So they're you know, massive contributors, and the volume of work they've produced on Masters would rival any other collaborator on Masters. So that just to sort of take stock and think about their involvement in the franchise and their contribution is just amazing. So, you know, thanks to you guys to the Horsemen for what they've contributed. But Mythic Legions is, I guess, you know, Four Horsemen don't only sculpt for other companies. They've got their own line, and they've had a number of lines that have come before. But Mythic Legions is where they're at, and they launched their Kickstarter 2.0. And they were looking at basically funding $140,000 to do 19 odd figures. They ended up absolutely blowing it out of the water, hitting all their stretch targets and coming just shy of $1 million. So they wanted 140 grand. They ended up getting $934,000. So just blew it out. They hit, you know, like I said, all the stretch targets. I think we're getting in the order of 34, 35 figures, plus weapons packs. You know, and as we got more and more targets, they were throwing in, you know, new accessories to the figures they'd already said, yeah, have another head, have an extra weapon. They were just chucking stuff in. And this thing just went absolutely nuts. So I just want to just chat briefly or plug briefly a little bit about this line. So essentially, for the Mythic Legions is a fantasy line. So it's bringing in, you know, subject matter that I think we probably all resonates to us with, you know, it's got that Lord of the Rings or that Ray Harryhausen sort of feel to it, with skeleton warriors and goblins and orcs and knights. vampires. So yeah, real fancy element, but done in a sculpted in a I guess a way that, that you know Eric sees these characters or see these factions looking, and they look sensational. The Kickstarter 2.0 for Mythic Legions utilizes a totally new body type, and so it won't be you won't have interchangeable parts with the previous Mythic Legends lines, but all the characters are so interchangeable. They've got you know the heads are removable, the different armor parts are removable. I believe you know waist parts can snap off and belt parts can snap off, and you can really customize. So if you think what we've got with Classics is great in terms of being able to pop off heads and armor and move them around, Mythic Legions takes up that concept and brings it to the new level. So the figures will be available on Store Horsemen as they get released. I think in the due date for that is currently April 2018. So if you've missed the Kickstarter, you can get go directly to the website to buy these because they will produce more than the allocations for the Kickstarter. And the other thing about 2.0 was it was the first time it was including female bucks into the line. So prior to this, we didn't have any female representation. So 2.0 was a way to get the female buck and work that into the parts sharing system, having that more slender look that they could utilize in the line. So I guess the point I wanted to draw out in terms of your involvement in the podcast, Darren and Ben, was what listening to Eric talk, he was saying the 80s was such a great time because, you know, there was so much creativity and so many new properties that were coming out because, you know, at some time Masters was just a totally new creation that was made up by Mattel and put out there, and it, you know, had this huge following. And we were getting so many unique products. You know, we talked about Visionaries and you know, the use of holographic and Supernaturals. You know, we've got things like, you know, Dino Riders and Mask and Transformers and Ninja Turtles coming out. There was obviously Batman was heavily influenced. So we had, you know, a combination of well-known existing properties and new properties. I guess when you look at the landscape today, a lot of what we see from toy companies are proven properties, properties that have a background, that have a connection, that resonate with people. So, you know, licenses that might be 75 plus years old. And Eric touched on a point to say, you know, with Mythic Legions, this is, and Kickstarter, I guess, being an avenue to allow creative talent the ability to bring new concepts to bear on the market and do it in a way that, you know, is comfortable. They can get funding up front and then go into production, and it's sort of a safer bet. If people don't like it, it might not get produced, but if it connects with people, we'll get new imagination, new properties out there.
It's not going to send the creators bankrupt.
Yeah, that's right, because it would be a big thing for the Four Horsemen to drop $1 million on something that you know, might not resonate with their target market or their audience. So I guess the question I wanted to pose to you guys for this segment was, you know, from your personal collecting standpoint or viewpoint or where you're at, you know, what's your preference in terms of your collecting habits? And I know we've got space issues, we've got monetary issues, we've got a lot of properties out there that we love. Are you more inclined to put your money towards existing known properties that you've got a nostalgic connection to? Or do you want to see a bit more from properties that are totally new, that we haven't seen anything before, that's newly creative, relive the excitement of walking into a toy store and seeing a He-Man figure, a Skeletor figure for the first time?
It's funny you should bring this topic up, Trent, because I've been thinking about this a lot ever since that Kickstarter project went up by the Horsemen. And I've not said anything, so, but you probably have a sense because you've known me for a long time, so you probably have a sense anyway about what I'm going to say. Just a guess. I guess for me, and I've touched on this before, I think, on the podcast, I reflect on this a lot. It's something that I just do, you know, it's part of who I am as a toy collector, I guess, that I reflect, part of who I am as a person. I reflect a lot on different things, and I think for me, it's, I'm becoming more and more aware that it's about character and story and about how I can relate different characters to the stories I love and not only the stories that have been portrayed, but I guess the stories that come alive in my imagination. So the characters that I have the deepest connection with are the ones that I have some sort of history with. They might remind me of a time when I was young. They might, they might be a callback to a gift my grandma gave me, or a really good memory somehow that I connect with on what I'd call a fairly deep personal level, and that's probably what drives my collection. So they're characters, generally speaking, that I guess I grew up with. Having said that, I do find the Kickstarter project fascinating, and I definitely find, what seems to be, record-breaking, the amount of short time that it took for it to actually go through, and then for it to hit not only some or even most of its stretch goal targets, but all of them, I think shows that there's a lot of support for this property and this particular incarnation of it. I guess for me, I'd need to know a lot more about those characters and their story and how I'd relate to them before I, had the feelings I had for them that I have for some of the other properties that I grew up with. But that takes nothing away from the Talent of the Horsemen, who incidentally have worked on probably every one of my favourite properties, from Master Universe to DC to the NECA TMNT comic book line to even, if call me out if I'm wrong on this, the Ghostbusters movie line. So, some of those properties, I'm hugely grateful, as Trent said, for all they have done. And I really am intrigued by the properties they create themselves. Love to know more about them, and I tend to think that we might find out a bit more about them given how quickly the stretch goals went. You have to wonder whether or not a story could be offered in some form.
Yeah, it has been greenlit, so there is going to be a story. I think they've put up some images from that, what is essentially a comic book story, from what I understand.
I'd be intrigued to see more of that.
Yeah, and I think, a lot of great artwork as well coming out of that. Nate Bartsch from the He-Man community as well has gotten involved, and if you saw the image from New York at Toy Fair, the background artwork that they'd blown up and put there of almost like a goddess character, I can't recall the name of the character, but sort of like a very mystic sort of goddess type character, was done by Nate, and he's doing a lot of the work for the box art, and it's really, really top quality work. So it's great to see it draw from the fan community. And I guess, to your point, Darren, there will be some stories to kind of give us a bit more about the world mythos that the Four Horsemen created, and tell us a bit about the characters that live in that world.
For me, it's I'm big on nostalgia. So Master Universe, Transformers, Ninja Turtles, they're all probably my big three lines that I grew up with that have proven still to today are going extremely strong. So I'm less inclined to go after a brand new line. Because I don't have that nostalgic feeling towards it. But at the same token, I was at a catch-up meeting with some local toy people, and one of the lads there had a big bag of toys that he was giving to someone else that he'd picked up, and they were Sectors. And I don't think I've ever seen them before. I cannot remember seeing them in stores. Definitely did not have them as a kid. They're puppetry toys where you can put your hand in this giant spider, and the character, about the similar scale to the Thundercats toys, rides on this, puppetry beast. I fell in love with that toy line straight away. I had to seek it out. So I'm more inclined to seek out vintage toys than new toys for that reason. For that reason, I've gone back and collected Battle Beasts, and trying to complete my Tonka Supernaturals and the Sectors and all those things. I have so much pride for the vintage toys and what is still untapped toy lines that I don't have in my collection. And that being said, there's certain toy lines I just don't go near because I'll never... it'll be just an enormous money pit for me. Like Dino Riders, I had a few when I was young. I absolutely adore them, and I wish I had some now. But I can't help but feel if Dino Riders was reinvented in today's modern-esque toy, world, I don't think there'd be the same quality. I think the closest thing we've seen to Dino Riders in today's market is the Imaginex. They're big child kids toys that are around aimed to the 4, 5, 6 year old, and they're very robust and very plastic orientated, and not much pieces come off. They're sort of one thing. Whereas the Tyco Dino Riders of the 80s, just about everything came off. Like armor pieces, characters were only 2.5-3 inches tall, tiny little weapons and things, missile launchers, everything. I just don't think we'll see that in today's society. I would love to see it. I'd love to be proven wrong, but it's been so long since we've seen anything like that I can't help but feel it's a lost art form that we'll probably never see now after the 80s. Yeah.
I think you're right, and just touching on this, Trent's heard me say this many times, so I'll bore him with the same old joke that I often tell people. I regard myself as a child of the 80s, stuck in an adult's body, trapped in the year 2017. So that probably gives you a pretty big idea about where I sit in terms of nostalgia and that. But having said that, I do connect with new lines, particularly if they're properties that I already have a relationship with.
Yeah. Now, that's really interesting. It really resonated with me what Eric was saying, that I feel like a lot of what comes out today is broadly referencing, known properties.
I think you're right.
Walk down the toy line and what do you sort of see? You see well-established known properties. Where is that new line, that new toy line that you just go, wow, here's something really new and this could be so cool?
It's a podcast fascinating discussion in its own right. And I really think it is, because it harkens back to another issue that I talk a lot about, and about what I see is the decline of toys overall, and how we're seeing less and less stuff coming out. Toy departments are getting smaller. We have less toy shops. And I don't just mean in Australia either. I mean, it wasn't too long ago we were hearing about Toys R Us stores in the US closing, and quite a large number of them, and other toy chains have entirely disappeared right around the world. So I think it is something that is being wrestled with, and I can see why, if toys overall aren't seen as the sure bet they once were by toy manufacturers, it's only natural you're going to go back to things that have a proven track record, like Batman, like DC, like your Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, your proven performers, your Lego, your things that are going to be goals. I mean, it's no accident that one line or another of Batman has been on the shelf consistently since 1989. I mean, it wasn't too many years ago I read an article, I don't know if this is still the case, but Batman as a character was the single most produced character ever produced in action figure form, and that doesn't surprise me.
I think one toy line that probably does it better than any other toy line out there and continually does it better is Lego. And I mean, they've got the Ninjago toy line that they've run on for quite a few years now. Yep. Started from their own house and created the Spinjitzu or whatever they call. So you've got that sort of card game esque action feature, but Trent's son, or maybe it's his collection, I'm not sure, he's got some of the vehicles here, and they're very appealing even to myself, some animal like vehicles. And then on top of aside from the Ninjago, you've got the Exo Knights, and I couldn't help myself but stop and actually check out some of the Exo Knights, and especially some of the snake versions of the Exo Knights and things, and they are really cool. And my hat off to Lego for supporting the Star Wars and the Batman and the Marvel universe and things, but also still having a large enough budget to produce their own stuff, and not just your pirates and your city and things, but having a, you know, having a shot at creating something else, something completely new, something completely different, running with it. And it's obviously both, just those two properties alone are proven to be quite a success.
Absolutely. But Lego are the great innovators, and I don't know if you're both familiar with this or if our listeners are familiar with this. Pardon me on that. But Lego were only a handful of years ago going broke.
Yep.
They were on their way out of business, and they took a huge gamble and went to the bank and basically got the money to pursue the Star Wars license and turned it all around. I mean, up until then, Lego weren't licensing stuff. I mean, they've always been prepared to take chances and to re-energize. And it's by pursuing those licenses and putting out those proven performances, they've been able to grow and expand in what is dwindling toy aisles, to be honest. Let's be honest. We don't have as many toy aisles as we used to, and the stores that still sell toys have less and less. So, full credit to Lego for coming up with an idea that has allowed them to grow, so they can branch into things in addition to the licenses. And I love the licensed stuff. The Batman and DC and Turtles Lego from a few years ago was dream comes true stuff for me. But as Ben said, you know, they're bringing out all this new stuff and sparking the imagination of the next generation, and that's what it's about. You know, and I think what a different landscape it would have been if it had gone under.
Yeah. Lego is such a huge aisle in every toy store, and it would be an enormous gap in any toy store if Lego wasn't around. And you've got rival companies like Mega Bloks and things that are trying to create that magic, but I think the establishment that Lego has, you will never come par to par to Lego. I think they're the super creators of themselves, and you've got the imitators. The Mega Bloks and such will always be the imitators. They'll never quite be on the same playing field.
One of the issues that Mega Bloks and other companies might come across too is the nostalgia factor that just the Lego brand has. I mean, I can see that for families that grew up on Lego, it's going to be incredibly tempting, if they have fond memories of Lego, to then go out and buy that for their children. They're not going to have that kind of relationship. Again, perhaps, you know, my little way of signaling back to what the Horsemen have been talking about around, the power of nostalgia in the toy aisle and the power to influence your decisions, not only for your own purchasing habits, but perhaps if you have children or if you're buying a gift for a child, it's easy to be drawn into the stuff that you liked growing up.
Yeah. Now, they're really interesting thoughts. So thanks for going along with me on that little topic, because that was a really interesting topic to explore. And I think there's probably more there for another time.
I think there is.
But yeah, I mean, I'm a huge Dino Riders fan, and Ben's analysis was spot on to the thought I'd had. So obviously Tyco is no longer in existence. They were brought out by Mattel, I believe.
Yes, Mattel.
So Mattel technically owns the Dino Riders brand and could put out Dino Riders figures. And I my understanding is that at the 2015 San Diego Comic-Con, Mattel did actually tease us with some brands of things, you know, hey guys, we could get to these properties. Is this something you'd be interested in? And then obviously the Matty Collector model dissolved, and their avenue to get these sorts of products out to collectors probably evaporated with that. But Dino Riders was one of the things they said, look, we could put this back. And I always had that nervous hesitation to think, well, yeah, we've had Imaginext and what they've done in the sort of almost that preschool line, which they have done some essentially what are Dino Riders in the for the modern era. You know, my son always picks up this Ankylosaurus with this kind of tribal warrior or Neanderthal riding it, and he's really into it. Obviously, he's seen my Dino Riders collection, so he's got some connection to that. But it did make me wonder with more, I guess, the older kid market, you know, the last dinosaur figures we saw come out and absolutely flop was for the Jurassic World. I mean, the toys that were brought out by Hasbro, who had the Master Toy license at the time and no longer have it now, I think the Jurassic Park license has moved on. But that line was you know, I hate to be negative on this podcast, but it was horrendous. I had Dino Riders fans basically saying, I'm just buying it because dinosaurs, and then when they had it in hand, they just got rid of it because it was so bad. I mean, that was the state. And that's my concern for something like Dino Riders is you'll never be able to recreate those.
It depends on who does it. I mean, we're talking about Mattel owning it now. My mind is going to, well, you know, look at how much Dino Riders goes for on eBay. You know, and what
Ben alluded to about how all the hundreds of parts that people have lost.
yeah, and Ben alluded to how expensive it would be to delve into something like that. You know, and Super 7 have done a deal with Mattel for Masters of the Universe. Could they not, in theory, do a deal for Dino Riders? And would it be horrendous if Super 7 got it? I mean, it all depends on who gets the license or who produces the toys, I should say, because it may not be a license, Mattel own it. It depends on who produces the toys, who they're producing them for, and whether or not they think that would be a saleable item. I mean, you know, things are aimed at the adult collector. I mean, you know, there is a certain quality to them. I mean, I'm looking at, you know, some of Trent's Master Universe Classics figures now. Obviously, I've got the same figures at home myself, but as I'm talking about, you know, the quality of toys today, you know, and how horrendous they've been, I'm thinking it does depend on what you're trying to produce a toy for as to how bad it is and whether or not you're billing it as a toy or as an adult collectible or just how it's being marketed, because some things the technology has been kind to.
So my biggest concern with Dino Riders, if they were to remake this line for let's say for the mass market, let's put them on Target, Kmart shelves, Walmart, wherever you might be in the world. Let's put it in your local variety store. That's going to be aimed for the kids. There won't be nearly as much Snap-on armor. I don't think the dinosaurs will be much bigger than the vintage ones. I don't think you'll have the variety of aliens, would you call them? I just don't think they'll have that appeal to the adults because the vintage line will be so superior to the new ones. And therefore, my references to the Imaginex is about as close as we'll probably ever get them in a mass market.
And so, I think you're right, that's the key. Is it a mass market or is it something else?
So let's now analyze the adult market, right? So the adult market, would you go for a larger figure? So you're looking at a 2.5-3 inch figure. Would you go to up to the 5 inch, 5.25 or 3/4 size of a vintage Master Universe character? So that's double the size of the insectoid alien figure, and then think how large that dinosaur will be, and think how much the appeal to the adult market. You're talking for, let's say, the T-Rex, that would be the holy grail of an adult collector's, any adult collector's Dino Riders collection in a new version. That I dare say that would cost in excess of $400.
Yeah.
And how many people, would there be enough market out there for enough people to fork out $400 and to buy that one holy grail piece? I mean,
would you go that big though? Would you go more the scale of the vintage?
Look, I don't think that then there's not enough appeal.
It depends where they want to go with the line, and you make a really good point because I think it's the starting point, right? Because you say, what's the critical factor in the Dino Riders line? Is it the figures? Or is it the dinosaurs?
Or is it the nostalgia?
Yeah, look, and I think if you're going to go with adult collectors, you take the view it's nostalgia overriding. And then you've got a choice to make. You go, well, do collectors want to collect the action figures?
in which case you go down the path you were talking about, Ben, and you probably make them a bigger scale? Or do collectors want to get the dinosaurs, and really the people are less important, or they're almost secondary, that their scale is dictated to by the size of dinosaurs you want to produce. And to me, that's sort of where, you know, we had a, if we talk about, say, Kenner and what they did with their Jurassic Park, their Lost World line, they were in that sort of 5-inch, 4 to 5-inch scale figure. And then when we got into Jurassic World, they really dipped down. They scaled them down because I think there was more of a focus on the dinosaur or the vehicles. But then the figure was at such a small scale, it got lost, in my opinion.
Yeah. You and I had some pretty deep conversations about that at the time, and I remember saying to you, Trent, and this was just my view for what it's worth. People don't think I'm telling people how to think, but I have a really strong view. People talk a lot about continuity in films. They talk a lot about continuity in cartoons. I think the conversation has been neglected in terms of in continuity with toy lines, particularly franchise toy lines, where there's a sequel film in the works or whatever. I think the road that I would have liked to have seen them go down, I would have absolutely jumped on board with Jurassic World movie figures, would have been if they were in scale with those old Kenner, Hasbro, the three previous film figure lines, actually, you know, to be honest with you. If it was that sort of scale, I would have been on board, because that would have felt like this is the next step in a Jurassic, you know, no pun intended, a larger world. And it would have, you could have mixed the two lines together. If some of these other former stars returned to the franchise later, you could mix them quite nicely. They'd blend in quite well. There's no way you could do that with what Hasbro did with the Jurassic World movie line. There's no way you could look at them and, you know, it's just apples and oranges. So you couldn't mix them. And Mattel, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm just picking on Hasbro. Mattel had a 5-inch Batman Begins and Dark Knight movie line and Superman Returns movie line. And then for things like Green Lantern and even more critically, The Dark Knight Rises, scaled it down to a 4-inch and the scale was lost. So Hasbro are not the only ones who do that, but I do think it would be nice if we started seeing toy companies thinking about continuity of what's come before and seeing it as another layer of what's come before, because there are people that will only be on board if it fits in with what they've already got in mind. And we may not matter. Adults buying toys may not be the important thing, but then again, who knows? Our excitement might have been enough, and those adults who have children, that excitement might have been enough to get kids on board as well, if they had been something that did call back to our childhoods.
Yeah, no, very, very interesting. I loved having that debate about Dino Rise. I'm not sure how we got there, but it was a good path, because fascinating tour line. It's something I've thought a lot about, how they would do a reinvigorated line today, and without having, you know, life-size sort of, you know, dinosaurs that take up your whole house or something like that, you know, the Brontosaurus.
I'd love T-Rex. To know just how far advanced the thinking was, and obviously we're just probably talking about thinking, but the thinking was at Mattel, what they were envisioning a Matty Dino Riders line would have looked like.
Yeah.
That would have been fascinating, because obviously people think of Matty and they think of, you know, the 6-inch scale, Master Universe, Thundercats, you know, Ghostbusters, Voltron. DC, but Voltron was a different beast, no pun intended. You know, they were a different, you know, different scale.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, you do sort of wonder what the scale was they were thinking, where they were thinking they might have taken it.
Yeah, you think...
It'd be fascinating.
You think someone would have had that thought to put it up on a PowerPoint presentation and, you know, obviously delve through the archives and look at the properties they could draw on. You think they would have at least had some thought. I mean, maybe they just slapped it on there and said,
maybe it was just
give us some interest.
Maybe it was just a name that they thought, we'll see whether or not
it's possible.
Know, this resonates if people want it, and then we'll start costing in what it could be. But you have to wonder if it was more than that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, San Diego Comic-Con is a fantastic place to test fan reaction. So if you get it, you know, synopsis, you get it right at Comic-Con, you've guaranteed
a money maker, so to speak. So, you know, if the true hardcore fans don't like it, yeah. you might don't bother.
Give up.
So,
yeah. Save your money. Yeah. Fantastic. Thanks, gentlemen. It's been great having you around and really great to get back into Toy Power after a bit of a break. So, yeah, thanks so much to you guys and thanks to your listeners for tuning in again.
Thank you very much, Trent, for the invite as per usual. And thank you also to our loyal listeners for coming back. Hope to talk toys with you all again soon.
This was another exciting recording session. Many interesting insights from both of you guys. Thanks for everyone that's listened to this and hope to see you around the airwaves soon. This is Ben signing off.